Standing at the border of Ciudad Juárez, you'd witness something unexpected. Not just violence and chaos, but a meticulously organized business operation worth $300 billion annually. Drug cartels don't just peddle narcotics. They run supply chains that would impress logistics managers at Fortune 500 companies. They worry about quality control, customer satisfaction, and market share. They franchise like McDonald's, offshore like Nike, and innovate like Silicon Valley startups. This isn't romanticizing criminals. It's recognizing an uncomfortable truth that intelligence agencies and business schools have already acknowledged. The drug trade operates according to the same economic principles as any global industry, and until we understand this, every enforcement strategy will fail. What if the real solution isn't more guns and prisons, but simply better economics? Follow a kilogram of cocaine from jungle to city, and you'll witness capitalism's most dramatic transformation. Farmers harvest coca leaves, mixing them with cement, fertilizer, and gasoline to extract cocaine alkaloid. After filtering and boiling, 1 kilogram of cocaine base emerges. Further refinement with acetone and hydrochloric acid produces pure cocaine hydrochloride. Jungle lab innovations would impress any efficiency consultant. Cartels use ovens instead of sun drying, gasoline-powered hedge trimmers for chopping, and modified washing machines as centrifuges. Some labs operate from moving trucks to avoid detection. These improvements doubled Bolivia's cocaine yields in 3 years. By the time cocaine reaches American streets, its value has increased by 30,000%, yet law enforcement obsessively targets coca plants, the least valuable part of the chain. When Tijuana authorities burned 134 metric tons of seized marijuana, claiming $340 million in value, the actual cartel loss was likely under $10 million, less than 3% of reported value. The real markup happens during border transportation, not production. Why does Ciudad Juárez drown in blood while El Salvador's gangs occasionally declare peace? The answer lies in whether criminal organizations compete or collude. Under President Felipe Calderón, Mexico's murder rate doubled despite capturing 25 of 37 most wanted cartel leaders. Meanwhile, El Salvador's murder rate dropped 2/3 when rival gangs Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18 declared a truce. Same criminals, different market conditions, radically different outcomes. Ciudad Juárez became a war zone because 70% of U.S.-bound cocaine crosses there. Post-9/11 border tightening created only 47 official crossings along a 2,000-mile frontier, making each crossing point precious. When the Juárez cartel weakened after its leader died during plastic surgery in 1997, El Chapo Guzman's Sinaloa cartel moved in, sparking turf wars. El Salvador's gangs chose differently. In March 2012, Mara Salvatrucha and Barrio 18 divided territories into uncontested sectors. Unlike Mexican cartels fighting over scarce border crossings, El Salvador's gangs easily partitioned domestic extortion and drug markets. The murder rate fell 2/3 almost overnight. The counterintuitive lesson? Opening more border crossings could reduce Mexican violence by making each less valuable to fight over. Sometimes the solution isn't fighting harder, it's understanding the market conditions that make fighting inevitable. When a UK drug importer's $300,000 deal collapsed because his driver photographed himself with the cash during an affair and the driver's jealous wife tipped off police, it illustrated how soap opera lifestyles frequently cause traffickers' downfall. Cartels face a fundamental HR challenge, recruiting trustworthy workers in a secretive industry with high turnover, then managing relationships without legal contract enforcement. Prisons serve as perfect recruitment centers. Carlos later met smuggler George Jung in prison, and together, after their 1976 release, they revolutionized cocaine trafficking with Pablo Escobar's Medellin cartel. Later called Danbury Prison his college. Jails function as criminal HR departments full of potential recruits with nothing to do and no prospects. La Nuestra Familia, a California prison gang, operates with an elaborate constitution featuring a 4-tier hierarchy. After a 1978 embezzlement scandal, they replaced their single general with a three-person governing body requiring two-thirds majority for decisions. In wealthy countries, trafficking organizations often use minimal full-time staff. One British operation, generating $60 million annually, ran on just two people with contractors. Organizations often organize along ethnic lines, using family ties as insurance. Colombian operations collect family information to enable revenge if anyone absconds. The Dominican Republic's prison reform disrupts this pipeline. Their model prisons isolate gang leaders, ban cell phones, provide education and vocational training, and employ specially trained staff earning triple traditional salaries. Though expensive at $12 per prisoner daily, reform reduced recidivism from 50% to under 3%. When El Chapo Guzman was arrested in February 2014, thousands marched in Sinaloa wearing "Shorty is more loved than politicians" shirts. A nationwide poll showed only 53% approved of his arrest, one of business's most dramatic PR coups. As violence escalated in 2010, professionally printed narco mantas appeared across Ciudad Juarez. One message, purportedly from El Chapo, proclaimed, "I do not order the killing of children and women. I do not condone extortion or kidnapping," blaming rival La Línea for destroying the state. Recognizing public support helps fugitives evade capture. Cartels shifted from advertising to controlling editorial content. In Reynosa, they created a complete news blackout. One journalist murdered, five vanished in 2 months. Jose Vladimir Antuna was found dead with a note, "This happened to me for passing information to soldiers." Cartels target two audiences: the public, convincing them rivals are more violent, and the government, preventing coverage to avoid troop deployments. They sometimes remove bodies after shootouts to minimize violence evidence, or deliberately dump them publicly to provoke crackdowns in rivals' territories. From El Chapo's $1,000 tips to Pablo Escobar's housing projects, narco-philanthropy builds community support by filling institutional voids where governments fail. Mexican drug cartels discovered offshoring in the late 20th century, making Central America their trampoline. 80% of U.S.-bound cocaine passes through this isthmus. They established permanent operations with processing labs, importing their violence alongside their business. The cartels found abundant cheap labor. In Guatemala City, Jose became a hitman at age 8. With annual incomes of $3,500 in Guatemala and under $2,000 in Nicaragua versus Mexico's $10,000, cartels hire workers cheaply. Even more valuable are ex-members of Guatemala's feared Kabila's special forces, who committed civil war atrocities and now work for traffickers. Guatemala's government has been systematically gutted. The army shrank from 30,000 to 10,000 soldiers, leaving just 32 troops patrolling 200 miles of Mexican border. Public spending sits at 12% of GDP, Latin America's lowest. Private security guards outnumber police 5-1. Honduras exemplifies criminal-friendly corruption, with one purge dismissing 150 of just 570 evaluated officers. Between 2005 to 2010, cartels aggressively bought land. Ownership changed in 90% of Sayocshe, 75% of San Jose, and 69% of La Libertad in Guatemala's Petén department. Where legitimate businesses seek strong institutions, cartels thrive on weakness. Combating cartel offshoring requires better metrics: a security index measuring police ratios, officer salaries, extradition laws, and wiretapping capabilities would create incentives for improvement. Texas officials once inflated drug seizure values tenfold by switching from wholesale to retail accounting, turning invisible enforcement into a $1.6 billion victory. Meanwhile, Britain's Office for National Statistics measures illegal markets seriously. Drugs and sex contribute $7.4 billion and $8.9 billion respectively to GDP, exceeding agriculture's value. The war on drugs makes four critical economic errors. First, obsessing over supply ignores that raw materials represent less than 1% of cocaine street value. Drug demand is inelastic. A 10% price increase reduces marijuana consumption by only 3.3%, cocaine by 1.7%. Successful enforcement raises prices without reducing consumption, actually increasing the criminal market's total value. Second, governments save money early and pay later. New Hampshire cut $15 million from prison education, while Tiny Keene spent $286,000 on a military vehicle despite three homicides in 13 years. Yet every $1 million spent on treatment reduces cocaine consumption by 100 kilograms, 10 times more effective than enforcement. Third, national responses fail against global businesses. The UN celebrated pushing coca from Peru to Colombia in the 1990s, then back to Peru a decade later, achieving nothing overall. Fourth, prohibition isn't control. After $1 trillion spent, marijuana and cocaine consumption increased by half, while opiate use nearly tripled. Colorado's legal regulation shows the alternative. Safety-tested products, age restrictions, $76 million in tax revenue, and arrests dropping from 30,000 to 2,000 annually.